death has come to your little town, Sheriff. You can either ignore it or you can help me to stop it.
Hi, my name is Robert Lendrum.
And I'm Jamie Roberts.
And this is Running Scared,
the podcast where we review the movies that had you running away but coming back for more.
Jamie, we just did that in a one take. First time ever, man. One take. Nice. Jay-Z approach here for us today.
You like that, eh? Yeah, you know what? It's practice. I figured going into the fifth or sixth movie, we'd be ready to go. So, Rob, how you doing, man?
I'm good. We, you know, moved into the house, slowly but surely knocking the boxes off one at a time. We got a couple left, but it's starting to feel like home a bit.
I was over there, man. You had the kiddie pool out. You had the barbecue rolling. Like, everything looked nice. A little patch of grass in the back. You know what I mean? It's looking good. The inside of the house looks fantastic, man. You guys are going to be really happy there and love it.
Yeah, the neighbors have been great. They already are cool neighbors across the street. Dropped us off a couple beers from the local Fairweather Brewery. Have you ever tried that?
Fairweather. Love Fairweather.
Yeah. Free plug for Fairweather.
Yeah, exactly. Grain and Grit and Fairweather, two of my favorite breweries. I can only get up there, you know, every... I don't know. It seems like every maybe once a month, right? But they're up in the West End, close to me. But, you know, in Hamilton, everything is close, right?
Yeah, so. But fantastic. Tasty stuff.
Good stuff, man. Okay, so what are we doing? What are we doing tonight, eh? It's we had some time spent creating the Jogcast, and hope everybody has enjoyed the first episode. We've got the second episode that's going to be coming out really soon after we have Halloween Go, which is what we're doing tonight. And actually, I think we talked about this, Rob. We're going to put the second Jogcast on the main feed so that everybody can enjoy and follow along in the story of the zombie apocalypse and see if Jamie and Rob get out okay. And then
Hell in Hamilton Part 2.
And I think we'll put the third one on the Patreon. And
well, you said that about the second one. Now you're like,
I know.
People have it. I want the people.
Hey, I want the people to have it. You know, I went out running with, you sent me one of the cuts today. I went out running with it and I played it. I played it twice. I listened to it and then I just, you know, rewound it and played it again. And then I ended up running for like 35 minutes with it. It was fantastic.
Well, they're supposed to be fun, entertaining, and, you know, just something that you've been interested in. You're an exercise guy. You're a jogger. I'm getting into the sport a little bit, if you call it a sport.
Is it a sport?
It's exercise. What does Kenny Powers say? I
fall somewhere in like fox hunting. And
what does Kenny Powers say?
I play real sports. Not trying to be the best at exercising. Fuck this guy.
Anyway, yeah, so it's fun. It's a cool thing. It's a fun thing for us to do. It's also just letting us flex some different muscles and try some things. And it's kind of goofy, but we're totally loving it, having fun with it. And we also did a recording this past week of the long-awaited Anaconda recast. So that will be on the Patreon as soon as I get a chance to cut that, because it's going to be an epic cut. Let me tell you, that is...
Why do I feel like that thing just spiraled out, not out of control, that's not the word, right? Like the movie spiraled out of control. I think the recast took on life of itself.
Oh, yeah.
And when I came into the session, you threw like an 86 mile an hour curveball at me. I had no idea it was coming. The only thing I can tell out to the fans is it involves Ed Sheeran and heavy metal. So hopefully you get a chance to sign up to the Patreon, take a look at that. You know, you can find it. It's on our link tree. You can get that in the bio. You can get that on Twitter, on Instagram. So you can find it on Patreon. If you want to support Running Scared Podcast, help us make content, bring it to you. We love doing it. And it just helps if, you know, we got a little bit of bank in our pockets, a little bit more to be able to do it a little bit quicker.
Yeah, because we reached out to a friend of mine who's a fantastic video editor. His name is Jason Kerr at Big Cat Media. He is cutting Jogcast 2. And already we're hearing like quality difference just from the rough cuts. So like, I'm okay. I kind of know what I'm doing, but this guy really knows what he's doing. It really, really enhanced the whole thing. And the other thing is, if you're going to sign up for Patreon, it'd be really cool if you checked out Slasher Mode. You get a discount on the highest loyalty program at a discounted rate. And it's like everything that we ever add to that tier, you're going to get. And it's only available for the first 15 patrons. So those of you want to get involved or want to help us out, that'd be so cool.
And Rob, you know what else is really exciting? We are going to be doing something new at the Running Scared Podcast this Friday, because it is Friday the 13th. We are going live with Twitter Spaces. What we've decided to do is to kind of kick back a little bit, chill out, get together, maybe have a couple of beverages, mm-hmm. and throw on a Friday the 13th movie. The installment that we've chosen is one of my favorites. This is Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives with Tommy Jarvis. It's got a great climax. It's a fun movie. It's got some great kills. So I think it'll just be cool to kind of, again, just kind of chill out, have a brew, and watch the film, be in the same space. Really excited about that. And really just to engage the listeners, maybe invite some of our Twitter friends up and see if, you know, if we can't get a nice little group of people just hanging out and watching the film.
Yeah, I got to get my buddy Winston McMartin over at the podcast, The Dark Side of Sport, see if he'll join on. Because, yeah, Twitter Spaces, if you're not familiar with it, it's a lot like Clubhouse. You join in, you can just chat. We're going to pull people up on stage to chat. And, you know, you drop in for 5 minutes if you want, or you can hang out the whole time. So it's a zero commitment. You just kind of come and go. It's just a great way for us to meet more people in the Twitter community and, you know, reach out and see who else is interested in the same stuff we are and, you know, get to know each other.
And don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter at Running Scared PD. And then you can find us on Instagram at Running Scared Pod.
Jamie, today the fans have spoken from our Twitter poll. We are reviewing the original 1978 John Carpenter film, Halloween.
Yeah, Rob, Halloween. You know, we put it out there as a poll. We looked at some of the classic films. I think Halloween was on the list, Friday the 13th, Candyman, Child's Play. And one of the best responses was from a listener who just said, easy, and then clicked on Halloween. And that's how I felt, you know, going into it. I had my favorite that I wanted to do, and I'm glad that the people spoke and we are doing Halloween. This is a classic film. This is perfectly kind of situated in the pantheon of our age categories here, Rob. Actually, my birthday's tomorrow.
I know. I'm not gonna say anything.
Please don't. Please don't, you know, because I'm, you know, not that it matters. I'm going to be 42 years old tomorrow. So can you believe that, Rob?
And when I'm ahead of you, so I totally believe it. Yeah.
Yeah. When we were kids, I remember watching this film. We watched slasher films as a kid. Mm-hmm. You know, we watched The Exorcist, we watched Amityville, and then we got into these slasher franchises. And this was one of the first ones that we watched. And I fell in love with it, just everything about it I like. And, you know, one of the things I think at the end is we'll talk about, you know, how does this movie hold up over time? Because this movie has been reviewed and talked about and totally examined for the last, you know, 40 years, right? So what can we bring new to this podcast? I say we bring our experience with the movie and we try to, you know, just let you know how we felt about it, what we get from it, and why we think it's great or why we think things could be improved with it.
Yeah, and speaking of franchises, Jamie, this one really is the one that starts that trend, right? I mean, Halloween precedes Friday the 13th, precedes Nightmare on Elm Street, and this is really where they developed the idea of, hey, you know, we could make this movie over and over and over again and keep making a whole franchise of these. And I haven't watched Halloween 2 recently, but I definitely have seen it, and I remember Halloween 2 picks up like literally the scene after the end of Halloween 1, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, listen, there's no spoilers in a movie that was made in 78 with the second one coming in 81. The second one is just a continuation of The Night, which is amazing. But speaking about this being the blueprint for the slasher franchise, this was it. You know, Friday the 13th gets going in 1980, Nightmare on Elm Street earlier on in the 80s. And then I remember, this is John Carpenter's movie, but I was watching something with Wes Craven and he talked about trying to recreate that next sort of franchisable antagonist mm-hmm. in the vein of a Michael Myers, in the vein of a Jason Voorhees, like these iconic antagonists, these characters that you're terrified of, but they have so much presence on screen that it was something that was, especially in the 80s, 90s, and I think so forth, maybe not so much now, but trying to create that character that's just, you know, that's lasting for many reasons, right?
Yeah, because I think what we want to talk about, Jamie, are the things that we think are great about this film. What are the things that solidify this as a classic? And we'll go through that list. And one of the things is you and I were both like, let's go up with five things. We walked away, came back together, and it turned out we were pretty much on par for 4 out of 5 of them.
Yeah, so absolutely.
There is one spot where we're going to diverge and talk about two different things, but for the most part, it looks like we'll be chatting up the same points. But that's fine because I think we have different things to say about it. So let's get into that.
Okay, let's work our way down. So number 5, we agreed that, well, I actually had lighting and music, but I think we just talked about the music as itself is being so iconic about the film. We agreed there, right, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, we've referenced this a few times in our other pods. I think we actually cut out like a whole 3-minute section in our It Follows review where you and I just went off about how cool the music was and how it like had such a reminder to Halloween. However, you pointed out, I think in that pod, we actually cut it, but you pointed out Halloween 2 is where we really start to hear that synth noise as being sort of the common instrumentation. Whereas in this one, there it might be a touch of it, but the main theme, the famous Halloween theme that Carpenter wrote himself, is basically that piano that's played in, correct me if I'm wrong, music guy, because I'm not a music guy. What is it, 5/4 time?
Yeah, this is in 5/4 time, right? So 5/4 time is different than 4/4 time, right? When you think of something in 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, this kind of forward momentum. 5/4 is like an irregular time. It's like an offbeat, off-kiltered kind of feel to it, right? And the way you count 5/4 time is in two groups. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2. It's that syncopated feel, right? Where that beat's coming a little bit early.
Yeah, it causes a little pause or like a little trips or something. Because the notes are so repetitive that like on the piano, it really, really feels eerie and feels ominous and relentless.
So listen to this. So this was probably about 6 years ago. And we talked about this in the first pod, you know, we come from two schools here, right? No pun intended, not a double entendre, but Rob, filmmaker, producer, I'm a musician teacher, right? So this is where we're coming at it. And I remember walking into class and walking into the music room. And if you've ever been in any music room, you know, in middle school or high school, probably there's a piano. Music programs have changed and there's a lot more technology and there's Macs all over the place, but generally you're going to find like a piano. And I remember this one kid, I'm not going to say his name, and he got onto the piano and he started to play something. And I knew what it was right away. And you know what I'm going to say, what it was. I started teaching, you know, 11 years ago. So this was probably 8 years ago. So we're still talking in like, you know, recently. And this kid started playing the theme to Halloween. And no, this is a true
creepy
story.
Kid.
No, actually like a cool kind of hip kid, whatever you want to call him, right? Just one of the music students, right? And he's playing it, right? And he's playing not the fast pace percussive motive that's going on behind it, but he's that melodic or that more like that ostinato, right? That motive, that piano motive that continues. And one by one, the kids in the room are drawn to the piano. And then I just continue to watch. And no, did he get everybody in the room over to the piano? No. But I would probably say 10 kids are hovered over the piano and he's playing it. And he didn't even add in those, you know, those big synth chords. Bom, bom, bom. Like those are so impactful when you actually hear it in the movie. But it was just that repetitive motive that he would continue to play. And he played it in 5/4 time. And these are kids in 2014 that, you know, to me didn't seem like horror fans, but they were connected and they were drawn to the music. And I asked myself, why were they drawn to what he was playing when he had nobody around the piano? And the only answer I could come up with is just the notes, the music itself was drawing the kids there. And a lot of times we can't explain why something is iconic or legendary or so impactful. But in that moment, to me, it was very clear that this piece of music was, you know, impacting these kids. And you think about it, for all the things you said, it's eerie. It is simple. It's also in the perfect range. It's not too low. it's not too high. It's not piercing. It's like in that kind of upper mid range that everybody can have like an auditory sense and connect with. Carpenter is not the best piano player, as he said himself, but there was a lot of thought into the music. So then he's got that theme that continues. It really draws you in, right? And it doesn't change. It doesn't really get too high. It doesn't get too low. And then he's got these synth big bass sounds that come out, right? That kind of give a little bit more teeth, a little bit more grit. Like that's Myers stalking, right? Like everyone else is kind of just the atmosphere. And then Myers is coming in. If you were kind of think about what it would.
Yeah. The way you said that, it's actually interesting because I think of the piano is like almost a representation of the fear. Yeah. And what you call it, the synth underneath, that is Myers.
If you were to conceptualize it as an actual visual, that's the way I see it, right? And I think because they're very different, they're very different ranges, they're very different sounds. The texture that it creates is, you know what I mean? Like it's you can tell it's very distinct. Okay. I guess is what I'm trying to say. And just very different. And they just work beautifully well. And then if you listen to that opening theme, there's a slight crescendo, kind of builds up, but all in all, very simple, very nuanced, very eerie, but just every note that he picked was absolutely perfect for what he was trying to convey on screen. And if it connected with kids 40 years later, and it connected with the audience, you know what I mean? He's certainly done a good job. So,
yeah, all this time you're telling that story, I thought you were going to say Benny and the Jets. I was just waiting for Benny and the Jets.
It's a masterclass, you know, in creating horror music, eerie music. And one thing to note, he avoided the use of strings. You know, he's got the synth, but it's mm-hmm. in such a low range that it really more feels like a percussive accent anyways, right? Like he doesn't have those high strings like the, you know, that kind of stuff you see in Psycho. It was different and it was fresh and it was new and it was perfect.
Let's move on to our next point, which is the star of the movie. And we're not talking about Michael Myers. We're talking about Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yes, what do you say? What was the word? Prudish, conservative protagonist?
I don't know. Maybe she's not conservative.
Is she,
eh?
Like, is
she's
she
prudish
that?
Or she's, I don't know, she's just inexperienced or she's shy. She's obviously the smart one. They actually kind of identify that. She even says, like, guys don't like me because I'm too smart. Or guys think I'm too smart, so they don't date me.
Yeah. Old Ben Tramer. Have you ever, like, I'm sure, Rob, you've known a girl or you've known women, girl from whatever, that they are just quiet. But once you get to know them, they open up and they are a lot more confident, a lot more assertive.
Freaking the sheets.
than you would have thought. And that's just all about just kind of like getting them, having them comfortable, having them open up. I feel like Laurie Strode is that character. She's got a lot of responsibility. Even just the beginning, right? Where her dad is asking her to do things. It's not uncommon, right? But, you know, he's asking her to drop houses off at the Meyer house. He's clearly a real estate agent. So she's got responsibility. She's good in school. But she's interested in boys. She has her eye on somebody, you know, and she's got these other friends that I think really overpower her because they're just so over the top, right?
They are. Like, they're, like, you know, they're almost cartoons.
Come over and have some popcorn and have, you know.
Yeah, they're kind of cartoonish and they're so like, don't be such a prude. Like, they're just totally like,
come on, Lori, just ask them.
Yeah, they're peer pressure to the max, right?
You know,
they're good. Like, I love those characters too, but they are a bit silly.
Yeah, like their naivety and just the way they carry themselves, like, gets themselves killed, right? That overconfidence and just, but with her, they just overpower her. But I think that makes her all the more interesting as a character because throughout the whole film, do we really know that Myers is after Strode? Like, does she know?
No,
I think
we have
she
no
does
idea.
Because we have all these moments of him popping up, right? Like, he's you know, like he's fucking everywhere, this guy. Like,
yeah. Okay. So this is, and I mean, we'll save it for the, does this movie hold up? But there is like an hour in this movie. Like it's at least 40 minutes where like nothing happens. Like they go babysit. And during this time, Michael does about six peekaboos. Like yeah. he just like, And Laurie catches him almost every time, which is kind of silly because it's like, wouldn't she be getting super weirded out by the time, okay, he's in your backyard. Oh, he's around the corner from your bush. Oh, he just drove by. Oh, wasn't he outside your window of your classroom? Like it starts to pile up in a way that I'm like, Laurie, call the cops, this guy.
But you know what? Like she asks her friend, right? Is Mr. I can't remember what his name is, right? The guy that's got the, got his laundry out. All whites.
If dingy whites embarrass you, you'll love Oxydol's tough cleaners.
All tablecloths.
I did not catch that. It's hilarious.
Like, you know what I mean? There's nothing else this guy wears.
Also, that scene, that laundry scene you're talking about, that backyard scene, there's a fuck up in that edit because Lori's looking at the window. She sees Michael Myers, right? They cut back to Lori. She's still looking in the same place. She hasn't looked away. And then they cut back and Michael's gone. Like that peekaboo disappearing act only works if the person's eyes change and avert from what they're looking at.
Yeah. Like she should have. Like, no. Isn't there a phone call in there?
No, it watch the cut. It doesn't happen until after. So like, it's like they meant for the phone to do it, but they forgot to edit in that order. It just doesn't make sense. Like she's staring at him. He stares at her. You cut back to her, still staring at him, cut back, and he's not there.
And like that, he's gone.
Take a look at it. Yeah, you're right.
It's just a bad cut.
We think about horror film construct, right? Like the buxom female is being stalked and targeted and eventually killed, and they had to sort of fit that profile. And Jamie Lee Curtis kind of fits that perfectly, right? You know, she's got the lineage with Janet Leigh in mm-hmm. her corner. And then she, again, well, probably
from Psycho.
From Psycho, right? Well, I assume, you know, I shouldn't though, but I assume that the listeners would know that this is Janet Leigh's daughter who is in the original Psycho. So I don't know if that's how she got the job, maybe. I don't want to say that nepotism played into it. But,
well, the doc I saw, they said like they liked her and they had tried for someone else that they couldn't get. And they liked Jamie Lee, but they definitely saw like that as a potential way to help market the film.
Oh, really? Eh?
Yeah. So it's not like maybe a little nepotism, but I think also she had kind of won them over. And
well, she looks the part. Now, when you actually when you watch the film, I couldn't picture anyone else in there because, you know, she is attractive, but not overly. I don't want to say overly so. Like she is attractive, and she's just not like over the top in her look. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's tall. She's a brunette. Again, attractive, right? And just kind of fits that role nicely. So I think that she works well. She's a great screamer. And she plays, like, we got to fast forward to the ending of the scene, right? Where she understands something's up, right? Like, she goes over to find her friend, and then her friend is dead. And then she, you know, you've got that shot of her coming out of the house. She's like frantic. She's hysterical. She's going over to people's houses trying to find help.
Yeah.
And it's really like the shot itself is not up close. I love the fact that the shots of her, especially at the end, and then Myers, we can talk about, are shots from so far away. You see everything, right? You see all the entire house. Like it really, I think they're trying to work with scale here, right? To see sort of how far she needs to run to get help. Maybe how big these properties are, to see how much time when you see Myers come into the shot, like really you're trying to make judgment and measurement as to how much time she has, right? So you're thinking while this is all going on, I think it's great. She plays the woman, the protagonist about to be killed, being stalked perfectly, and the way she fights, the her expressions, her performance and her acting in the closet scene at the end when he is, you know, she's on death's doorstep. She uses the coat hanger because she's babysitting and she takes it seriously. She's got Tommy Jarvis there. She's got to make sure. So, you know, like,
oh,
Tommy
and the Jarvis. Kid from next door, because she's babysitting. Remember the other girl dropped off the little girl.
Yeah, the one that's watching.
So at this point, Laurie is actually watching over two kids.
So she just has a very, you know, she allows the movie to come to her, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? She doesn't go searching for it. She allows the movie to just to come to her. I think she does a great job.
Yeah, I think Jamie Lee becomes the archetype, right, for movies going forward. Another good example of, you know, she's the smart one. This is a subtle thing, Jamie, but I found it really interesting that when she enters the house where all the bodies are, she enters in the same door that one of the boyfriends came in, and he looked in all the cupboards or whatever, looking for whatever made the noise. And then Michael surprises him from the closet, right? Stabs him and sticks him to the wall. So when Lori enters that house, she actually looks first at the place where Michael popped out. It was a really interesting, like, it was really like smart and somewhat tense. Like, it really built up the tension quickly. Because I'm like, oh man, she's going, like, that's where he was. Oh, what if he's trying to pull that out again? But, you know, he's not there now.
Yeah, exactly. But
point is, like, she automatically kind of identified the weak spot and was like, she looked at it right away. I don't know. Very subtle.
No, I think, but it was smart. It speaks to how many times we watch movies and we say, no, don't make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, make the right decision. And she comes in and she makes the right decision. You come in, don't check under the flower pots. Don't go up. You know what I mean? Like,
things that are too small. Open
the fucking closet door and see if somebody's there. Right.
Right.
You know what I mean? Just be pragmatic.
Yeah.
Be logical. Follow your gut. You know what I mean?
Oh, and I think one thing, James, this is not a Jamie Lee thing necessarily, but when Michael first slashes her, he misses her kind of and cuts her arm instead. Yeah. And I'm not sure. Part of me wonders if Michael is trying to torture her a bit instead of just killing her the way he did the others. Because, you know, he generally does an attack from behind. Well, no, he did the strangle. Anyway, so he slashes her arm. Then he throws her down the stairs. Not like roll her down the stairs, like over the banister. And the movie does the best it can to visualize this with like a weird, you know, spin kind of move that it does. And we just see Jamie laid out on the ground and she's like, oh fuck. And then she like peels up and keeps running or whatever. And I was like, that is a harsh, like, you would not be jumping up from that one. You wouldn't be like popping up and running away. You'd be like, oh my God, my back. Like, he just broke her back.
Yeah. It makes it think like she's trying to torture a little bit, right?
That he's trying to torture her.
He's trying to torture her. He's also in that house of horrors. He's also pulled the headstone. You know what I mean? To put it on the bed, right, of Judith Myers, his sister.
There's another scene where Michael's just like parading bodies from the backyard to the front yard.
Yeah.
I guess because it's Halloween night, nobody gives a shit.
Or... I know. It's like he's moving garden soil. Hey? He's got 3 bags of peat moss he's got to put in the back. Exactly. No, but I know what you mean. Hey? And it's just because you just see it with all the silhouette, right? Because the way it's all the way it's all front lit, or is it backlit? Backlit, right? It's really good, but yeah, he's got the but he's trying to torment her, right? I think he's probably still not really refined his like killing technique. Is a lot of sort of understated kills here. You know, we don't see the gore until later on. That probably has more to do with, you know, the time period in which the movie was made, and also maybe speaks to the budget. But he's definitely playing. He's playing the long game here. He's created this ritual, this memorial, for her to kind of just be completely mentally shot, and then eventually, you know, physically. But he's not able to succeed here.
So let's jump to our next point there, James, because that's a perfect segue. Because this is the one point where we actually diverted. In my top 5 list of things that make this movie iconic, I just put the kills, like straight up how people died in this movie. And you went a different way. This was not on your list. So for me, part of what makes Halloween iconic is that the deaths are not gore and they're not slash. Now, that was something they were trying to do. They didn't have the money, the budget to really sell a gruesome, you know, blood splattery death. But I think they were also trying to make the kills more personal, smaller in scale, and like in that way, more frightening. And that was what they were going for. Something more psychological, like someone killing you, one person like trying to like coming up behind you and sneaking up on you and stabbing you, like all those kind of creepy elements that make Michael really are exemplified in the kills. The gravestone one being one, the guy being stuck to the wall.
Yeah.
To me, one of the funnier ones is the death of the girl in the car, because he like strangles her with the seatbelt. I think, is it? What has he got there?
Is it the seatbelt? The,
what does he have?
Yeah, it is. When she's got to go pick up her boyfriend to come, right? And it's the strangle in the car.
Yeah.
When she's just spilled butter on her shirt and she's in the laundry room. That's actually a really good scene too. We talk about a kill, and you talk about an understated kill, and one that really takes time to develop.
Oh my God,
the tension, because she's going back to the laundry room, she's going back to the kitchen.
She gets stuck in the window with her ass hanging out.
Like, yeah, like, come on, man.
That's like a whole porn genre right now.
Yeah. I don't know what's going on there.
To me it took way too long. I was just like, what is going on? Like, what more what role does this character who's about to get killed play at this point anymore? Like, why are we pacing out her death so much? Because at this point I was like, okay, I get it. You're gonna kill her. Like, why aren't we getting to the point here? And they sort of drag it out, and her final scene. It's kind of clever that she forgets the keys. She has to go back. She gets the keys. But now when she gets in the car, the door is unlocked, and she kind of forgets that she had just walked back to get the keys. So she just gets in the car, so then we find out Michael surprises her in the back seat. And then, like, it's not the greatest death, because you can tell in terms of the acting that he can't truly strangle her. And she kind of like goes cross-eyed. And so although that kill is kind of silly, I think what was interesting about Halloween was its choice to make kills smaller, to make them less gruesome and gory, and make them more personal, and strangulation and getting stabbed through the gut by something.
You know what? I want to make a point just about the...
Yeah, go ahead.
We were talking about Strode. I just want to, you know, one kind of straddles both Strode and the kills is, one thing I thought was interesting is that in a later franchise in Friday the 13th, often near the end of the... of the movie, you'll have the protagonist, or, you know, the double protagonists that are running away from Jason. It's near the end of the movie, the climax. And what they'll do is they'll run into a situation or run into an area or into a house or into like a barn where Jason's got all the dead people, right? He's brought them there, and he's kind of, parading them around, or he's displaying them almost
kind of
like
the set
a museum.
Piece of the movie, right?
Yeah, like exactly. Right. And this is, if not like one of the first movies that's doing that, right? Where Strode comes in, and then, you know, she opens up the closet, and then the blonde is there, right? You have Judith Myers on the floor. You've got the boyfriend who's got the knife in the stomach, and he's to the wall, right? Like, Myers has placed them there, which tells me that really speaks to the idea of it being personal, right? And, you know, I think of a parallel when you talked about the personal kills and not being gore, right? Like the first thing, I remember a professor that I had, and we talked about the difference between World War I and World War II. And this really has nothing to do with horror, even though that those conflicts were horrific and, you know, to this day, of course. But in World War I, the bayonets did all the killing, and you would see the death in the person's eyes, right? And it was personal, and it inflicted so much psychological damage. All war does, but you hear the stories from that conflict. But then when you get into later wars where people were killed from a mile away, 500 meters away, it was different. It's like the killing got easier, right? In this movie, you're right. All the killings are, and you hear it in his breath. You hear him grunt. You hear him moan. You hear him like groan, right? Is he enjoying it? It's so personal for him. It's such a part of who he is, which speaks to my next point of what I want to talk about in number three. So absolutely, right? The kills are personal, and they're not gory, and they are drawn out. I think that probably speaks to the fact that they had all their filming gear set up, and what normally would have been cut, like with the scene with Annie where she's walking back and forth and then she gets herself caught in the window. I think probably some of that would have made to the cutting room floor, but they needed to get to 1:30. So I think that's why that, you know, 3 to 4 or 5 minutes stays in there, right? Is that all we have to say about the kills, Rob? Because there's not many. Like, there's 4 or 5 in the film, right? We talked about that. This is not like gratuitous violence with many kills.
They're not gory. They're not blood and guts and bone. It's just that it's this guy wearing this creepy ass mask, and he's doing these very personal kills. And I guess that's because that's where the movie starts, right? He's killing his own sister, and then it's evolving into this, like, he kills any lady who takes her boobs out. Because it seems like every woman he kills in this movie shows her boobs at some point.
Yeah, exactly.
what up with that, Michael?
Yeah, there's that kind of, you know, that's a perfect segue into my overall just impression of the strength of the subtext of the whole film, right? Like, there's just a lot of implicit understanding. And for me, you know, my third most iconic part of this film is Donald Pleasance. And that's Michael's Dr. Loomis. And just the, I think just out of the gate, when I talk about subtext and I talk about, you know, what am I trying to understand from this character? Now, he's very concerned. He is his doctor, and he talks about he's, you know, spent the first 7 years trying to reach him, the next 8 trying to keep him locked up. But all the while I get from him, he doesn't necessarily come out and say it, but I get that he is just absolutely fearful of this person. He is absolutely frightened, yeah. terrified of him,
yeah.
on one hand. And on the other hand, even just the way he comes to the town, like he's like with a chicken with his head cut off. He's trying to find the sheriff. He says he's basically, you know, frantically trying to make his way back to Haddonfield. I think he just harbors an insane amount of guilt that he wasn't able to reach him, that he wasn't able to sort of unlock the key to the mystery of this child killer. And for me, he ends up just being just, you know, he's a secondary character, but really is a main character in the film, right? And just plays such a, you know, an important and crucial role. He knew right away when they pulled up to the gate to move him to the other psychiatric ward that something was gone. He knew he was behind it, right? Because of his experience working with this character. And, you know, through him, you get that in this film.
Dr. Loomis is our window into Michael's mind, right?
Absolutely.
We know nothing about Michael or why he is the way he is other than what Dr. Loomis tells us.
So that makes us trust him. That makes him to be like kind of a moral compass for the entire film. Like what you say or what he says is gospel, right? And the sheriff even say that, like, all right, Loomis, you know what I mean? It doesn't take a whole lot to convince the sheriffs in this movie. And then the second one moves to the hospital and the scene there. But also when we jump ahead to number 4, you know, it's just it was not the movie we're reviewing now, but like he basically rolls in and says, it's happening again. And the guy the sheriff, who through some other dialogue is kind of Cass's hard-nosed guy that says what he says, does what he does, basically just says, all right, Loomis, let's go. I want all patrols on all the blocks. You know what I mean? So he carries this seriousness. Well, that's interesting
because the first conversation Loomis has with the sheriff's like, I'll get all my guys looking for him. And Loomis says, don't do that. You'll just alert him that we know he's here. And I guess he's assuming that means Michael will just go into hiding and he'll just wait for his moment. And, you know, you'll waste a bunch of time, which I didn't understand. So I was like, you just told us this guy is pure evil.
Yeah, you want all your guys at home.
And you're just going to be like, nah, we'll just walk around town quietly and maybe just like hide behind some bushes and hopefully we'll just spot him.
Yeah, I love when he's talking to the sheriff too, or really anybody, he's always like looking, you know, he's looking around. He'll make his point and then he'll kind of look off into the distance.
Yeah, his eyes are darting all the time, left to right, right to left.
Yeah, he's looking, and I noticed that. I'm like, where is he? You know, he's like very twitchy. He's very on edge. You know what I mean? For Myers, right? But he is, and he knows, and he's very, especially if we talk about his performance, right? He has his moments where, you know, he gets a little bit more verbal, a little louder, but most of the time he's a very controlled character. The only time, or one of the times you see where he's not controlled, is when he's talking to one of the other doctors and saying, like, fucking goddamn it,
I told everybody.
I told you, you asshole, that he needed to be locked up. And you said, you know, you said this. And
the other doctor says something like, you should have told us. And he goes, I told everybody, goddamn it.
Yeah. More like it was an assault on bureaucracy than it was on, you know, just like he seemed like kind of the director of the hospital, down to, you know, checks and balances and budgets and ledgers, right? But Loomis knew. Loomis knew what needed to get done and nobody listened to him.
Oh, right? And Loomis is all about getting it done. He doesn't give a fuck. He's parked in a handicap spot. Roll it back. Take a look. That guy doesn't care, man. He pulled up in the handicap spot and he walked right in there.
He's using a cane.
Oh, come on. Really? Is he? Is he really? Is he using a cane?
Yes.
Oh, fuck. So he is. Fuck. I thought he was just like, fuck you guys. I'm parking right here.
Hold on. We have to go see this. All right. Here we go. Let's take a look at it, right? Oh, he is. Okay. No, he is without cane.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't.
It's only when he gets blown up in the second one.
Yeah, that's in a later movie. He gets injured. So but my point
that,
stands.
Maybe that just speaks to the, you know, the impertinence he has for his bosses, or just the, you know what? It's right in the shot, and it's there for a long period of time, and it's right up. It probably just is to make the point of how important it is, right? And just how quickly he needs to get.
No, it's because they were shooting and they couldn't put the car two spots away. They needed it to be as close to where they walked out as possible.
So then why wouldn't you pull the sign? Why wouldn't you just take the sign off?
I don't know. Maybe they missed it.
Oh, whatever.
Dude, there's palm trees in the background. This is supposed to take place in Massachusetts.
They trucked it in. His performance, and his typical British actor, right? Like,
what'd you think of his performance when he's doing those creepy voices to the kids? When he's chirping them from the bushes?
Hey, Lonnie, get your ass away from there.
Because he's trying to get the kids not to go in Michael Myers' house.
Exactly.
Don't come here. Don't. But he does like this fake American accent and tries to scare them.
No, listen, a lot of these British actors, you know, they are like Shakespearean trained. They're stage trained, right? So they really understand how to use their voice and embody a character. I think he's fantastic in this movie. And so did Carpenter. You know, Carpenter, one of the things is, you know, he got some extra scratch on it, but he was offered a percentage of the film, but it took the money up front. So like, you know, I don't think anybody knew this was going to be the success that it was, right?
No,
especially Loomis. And this guy's got like over 200 credits. 250 credits. He's been in a ton of stuff. You know what I mean? So, and certainly in 78, like I think he passed away in 95. In 78, he had done stuff 10 years earlier, right? So he kind of maybe knew what was going to be working and what wasn't. And he took the money up front. So maybe he didn't even believe. But
this whole movie is made by young people, like in their 20s, maybe early 30s, some of them, but most of them in their 20s. He's the oldest guy on set. Yeah. Most experienced. And
was he the most? Do you think you know what? You're leading me to it. Was he probably the most expensive actor? For sure, right?
Oh, 100% he was. Yeah. That's so confirmed.
So they're bringing him for kind of stage credibility. And he just does that. He brings like the elder statesman, right? He brings a professionalism to the
Carpenter was intimidated by him. He's talked about that, how he was like kind of like not scared, but sort of intimidated to work with him.
Really, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Well, because he's got good acting chops, right? And everybody else, like, he's the best actor by far in the film because nobody really acts. You know, Curtis does a little bit. Her performance is good and shows the potential in her skill. But he's the one that he probably has the most dialogue too.
So one of the coolest scenes from Donald Pleasance is right at the end when he shoots Michael. Michael falls off the balcony and he goes to look for the body.
Yeah.
Now, his reaction is maybe not what you'd expect. It's not of one of shock, like, where'd he go? It's actually a look of like, you know, he's still out there. Like, he totally looks around like, fuck, I knew this was going to happen. And apparently that was a real choice. And he put that forward to Carpenter and said, you know, do you want me to, I can play this one of two ways. One is shock and two is I knew this would happen. So Carpenter apparently said, this is from that doc I watched today. Carpenter said, can you just do both and we'll decide in the edit? And he was right that the better choice was Pleasant's performance going like, I knew this would happen. And that sort of is that steady hand of a trained actor that kind of says to you that the way this story ends better is when, you know, the relentlessness of this murderer is maintained. And it's not a shock like, wait, how did he survive that? It's like, God damn, I knew this was going to happen. he somehow keeps surviving and escaping us.
Oh, no, absolutely. I'm so glad you made that point. He looks down and there's no quick movements. You know, they're all subtle movements. He basically just looks forward, stares forward, and he kind of lifts his eyes. He lifts his head a little bit. But then what makes it work so well is that Laurie Strode, Jamie Lee Curtis's character, can almost read his mind or his eyes, and she breaks down in tears. She's hysterical, right? Because she knows that he's gone. Almost like the curtain coming down on the second act of Shakespearean tragedy. All he does is he takes his eyes and he, you know, sort of simply casts them, gazes them upward a little bit, and just holds the stare. Like Macbethian, I guess you could kind of say. And he just holds it right there. So it's a perfect, I'm glad you brought that up. It's a perfect example of how a lot can be done with eyes. Subtle, nuanced, right? And just with his face. He didn't say anything. Didn't turn around. Didn't move. Just moved his eyes. I think he's fantastic. I love him in this role.
All right. Great.
Yes. Okay, so okay, what do you want to do? You want to get down to number two, right?
Yeah, so this is, we call this two different things, but I think we both land on generally what we're talking about here is that, you know, Carpenter's direction, how Carpenter puts his signature on this film. I'm going to start off with the very first scene, and this is the scene where we are following through the POV of the killer, which is young Michael Myers, 6-year-old Michael Myers, looking through the window, coming into the house, putting on the clown mask, finding the knife, going up to his sister's room, and then killing her, and then exiting the house and coming up to the front steps. This sequence is very original. For its time, it was kind of groundbreaking. Now, I don't know if the POV of the killer had already been established, but I don't think it was well used yet, so it's pretty fresh in that sense. And then the other thing is, like, they used a Steadicam. And this is one of the early examples of Steadicam usage. Nowadays, we think of Steadicam as like commonplace. It's used in like fucking everything, but, you know, really came alive again in the 90s when they started doing hospital dramas and the Steadicam would be there to sort of swing around the ER room and things like that. But at this point, it was pretty new and, you know, really it was a cheap way of doing dolly shots. But the cool thing about Steadicam was now you could go upstairs. Now you could go around corners. Now you weren't bound to a track. And so this shot it's not one take. There actually is a couple cuts, but they're hidden. So it feels like one take. It's really well done. And that whole opening scene is done in this method before we get to the pull-out crane shot that we mentioned before that freezes the moment and then begins our film.
Yeah, that's well said. I think one of the things that, you know, he puts a signature on this film is with his hiring of Dean Cundey as the cinematographer. You know, you can go on and you can Google all about the lighting and, you know, some of the film choices, like the stock that was used for the film. But one of the things, if I look at it just as a layman, I'm not doing a podcast, I'm just looking at it just as a fan of the film. And as a kid, I always would ask myself, shit, like how do they get it to look so eerie and spooky and silhouette-y and with shadows? And, you know, you learn that the cinematography in the movie with a lot of the blue gels that they used to create those blues and a lot of the really the warm oranges, like with the interior lights, blue and orange, complementary colors, was absolutely on purpose. So if you look at those long sort of those panoramic shots of the houses, you know, we talked about earlier, right, where Myers is carting people around the home and like the side of it looks blue, but then there'll be like the pumpkin, which is orange, or you'll see like an upstairs light, which is turned on, saying like the first scene too, where everything else is really, really bluish, very darkish. And then you've got the interior light. For me, you know, they talk about it creating the classic horror look and it just being used, that blue light, you know, Hellraiser, all these other films, Jason, A Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, there's too numerous, The Ring, like, although that's got some different color combinations. But I think, you know, that is just such a signature part of like what makes this movie so good. It's an ingredient into the atmosphere with the type of shots that are being used, right? With sort of the building, you know, as the tension goes on. So, you know, that's the point that I wanted to make. I just think the, just, I guess we call it just the lighting. I think it's just a masterclass in lighting and just everything, the way it's all set up. And I think there was one scene specifically from the cinematography you want to talk about, right? That the one kind of classic one.
Yeah. So, Carpenter tasked the DOP with this idea of like, how do you demonstrate the idea that our eyes are adjusting to the dark? It's right at the end. Laurie Strode is in the all dark bedroom. And at the moment, we don't know, but there's a big black space behind her. And all they did, I guess they just threw one light and they just dimmed it just a little, or they had it dimmed right down. They just turned it up just a touch enough to reveal that white face of Michael Myers' mask hiding in that darkness. And, you know, that's a really cool idea to try to like challenge your DOP. How do you make this look like your eyes have adjusted? And of course, you know, it freaks us out as the audience before Laurie notices it's there. So just a cool, really cool execution there. And absolutely, like, it's not an easy thing to do, especially on such a low budget, but they came up with really clever, simple techniques like that, where they cast that one light and just had it way down and just cranked up the dimmer just a touch, just so you could see that face. And I wonder how many times they shot it to get it right, but like, damn, cool. Well done.
Yeah. You know what? So just two things. I'm looking at the scene right now. And yeah, you've got Strode on the left-hand side. You've got the light coming in, and then you've got, it's lit from the side, but then that dark kind of cavern. You actually see Myers, and then he goes away, and then you see him again when he actually comes through the door. Now imagine seeing this on the big screen, and imagine it being one of those old theaters, right, where it's not digitally shot. And I think that would just be amazing. Like just the whole feel and the whole atmosphere inside the movie theater with a scene like that, because, you know, we look at it on our computers or our TV screens, but imagine seeing it in a big cinema, I think would be amazing. Yeah. You see it and then it goes away and then it comes through and then all your eyes are just drawn to that white face. But when we like the tension of the movie, like you talk about, Rob, you said, you know, for an hour, basically nothing happens. I kind of got to disagree there. Like the only thing that's happening is we're adjusting ourselves to the pace in which he's sort of providing the movie at, right? So, you know, we're used to, you know, like things happening so fast nowadays in our lives, right? This, it was just a slow, slow burn.
Oh, yeah. No,
all these little, you know, and it can get played out a little bit, like just the umpteen stalking appearances, the pop-ups. Like I said, he's everywhere. Okay. And, you know, maybe one too many, but just very slowly. And then it's almost like as the day's unfolding where it's starting, the sun's starting to go down a little bit. And then you see the first trick or treaters out. So, you know, it's getting closer and then the sun's going down a little bit more and then they're driving and then somebody broke into the hardware store and then the sun's just about to go down. No, not a lot is happening other than to sort of set the night in motion. Everything is setting up for what's ultimately going to be just a night of terror. So
yeah, they're character building, but yeah, my issue was I looked at the runtime and I was like, good Lord, we're at the 50 minute mark. When is something going to happen here? But yeah, I know what you mean. This is a different time period. So it's a little hard to judge, especially because you're right. This was an attempt to revisit this genre and build it up in a new way. So this long, slow burn of tension was very deliberate. We should also give a lot of credit to Deborah Hill, who's the screenplay co-writer. And I think she had a lot to do with the production of this film. She basically produced it. So Carpenter kind of always gets all the love because he's the director and sort of the artiste, right, behind this idea. But I think Deborah Hill had a lot to do with it. After watching, and the documentary I keep referencing, by the way, is called A Cut Above, Halloween, A Cut Above. And you can see how much of Deborah Hill's fingerprints are all over this film when you watch that doc and how much she had to do with a lot of these big decisions that were made. Mm. All right, moving on, Jamie, let's get to the end of our top five. And we've covered, you know, the music, the presence of Jamie Lee Curtis and her big acting debut, really. Not really debut, but her big movie debut. The kills, which, I mean, I guess that kind of relates to where we're going here. Dr. Loomis, the direction of Carpenter. Now, finally, let's talk about the character, the icon himself, Michael Myers.
Is it me or has he jumped to the top of the list as the most iconic horror villain of all time?
It's a debate. It is a good debate because here's the thing for me, and maybe it's because I work in sports. Jason Voorhees' mask comes up so often, especially if you work in hockey in any way. That mask is so iconic. It comes up over and over again. Now, in general public, I mean, Michael Myers predates Freddy Krueger, predates Jason Voorhees, right? So he is the template.
Yeah, like I guess what I was going for with that is it a recency bias because Halloween, you know, you've had the Halloween reboot with Jamie Lee Curtis 2018, and then you've got Halloween Kills, which is everybody's just freaking out over, that's coming out this October. And then you've got Halloween Ends, which is slated all with Blumhouse Productions, right? Like, would it be a little bit different if we had, you know, we haven't had a Jason movie since 2009. We had the Nightmare on Elm Street reboot in 2010, but we've got all these Halloween movies now. Is it just because he's in the forefront right now, or is he just like the most badass for many different reasons that we can talk about?
Yeah.
In the pantheon of all these slasher villains, what do you think?
I think he's so much simpler than the other two and so much easier to understand, and like maybe not understand his motivation, but understand him as a force of terror. Jason Voorhees is supernatural, so he kind of, you know, he becomes.
But in a
something.
Lot of ways, I can understand that more. That's a revenge story, you know.
Yeah, but on who? Like, I don't know. Like, okay, so I know what you're saying, but like, Jason Voorhees is like, he's faceless in a way because he has that mask. He underneath it, especially when you get into the late sequels, he's basically like a zombie underneath. Like he's like his body is a corpse essentially. Like he's grotesque.
Yeah, once they freaking shot him up into space and, you know, like, he was able to make it back, like, you know, you knew that there was nothing living. You're right. So he's kind of, you know,
well, even before that, even in, like, I think in New York, he's clearly not human underneath. Like, they can stab him, they can do all these things, and he just keeps coming. So there's something about that that makes it something other than a person. And Michael Myers is still, even though I know eventually they make him kind of supernatural too, but
yeah, like they don't even bother to tell you how they get him back to life. He just starts every movie like alive again.
Yeah, but it still seems to boil down to it's just a guy underneath who's got some twisted problems in his head, and he, you know, he's just still a person. I mean, I get it that eventually they're going to take him that way, but at this point, after watching just Halloween 1, the original, that is all he is. Freddy Krueger is literally a figment of our imagination. He's like a magical
yeah,
gardener, whatever he is.
No, he's a janitor.
He's a magical janitor. He's a custodian.
Yeah, you're right. Thank you. Custodian.
So, you know, like he's also supernatural. So you have to have a sort of like level of buy-in just to watch the movie. You have to suspend disbelief quite a bit more. Whereas Michael Myers is just a guy with a mask on wearing a mechanic's outfit. Like he's mechanic's overalls. There's nothing else to him at this point, especially. So I think that's something makes him a little bit more longstanding and something more fearful about that. He sort of predates the Scream character. He's kind of, you know, he almost lends himself to like where the Joker takes you eventually. This idea yeah. that a man who's just so mad.
Well, he's exactly, and nothing jumpstarts his, you know, you think about some of these other ones, right? Like in Nightmare on Elm Street, there's a tragedy that's bestowed upon him that he comes back and seeks revenge. And Jason, his mother's killed, right? And he's drowned where people should be looking after him. So it's a revenge story. So there's a logical, perhaps.
Right. Yeah, right.
You know, it's rooted in logic. I was going to say pragmatism, but that's not the right word. It's rooted in logic in terms of why you would go on this harrowing killing spree. The way Myers is framed is a boy, an expressionless boy who cannot be helped. He is so evil and terrifying that he's not even worth helping. So 8 years old, what did Loomis say? Like, that's another thing, eh? Like, 15, 8. Myers is like supposed to be like in his early 20s when he's on this killing spree.
21.
So, you know, I've always felt that the character somehow should be like an adult, but he's not really an adult yet. You know, he's 21 years old. Who's really like, I guess you are an adult, you know,
legally,
but you know, meant like he's not, it's just an interesting age to kind of come back and to go on this killing spree. But you talked about Jason's mask, you know, a quick Google search is worth it for anybody. But an interesting story with Michael Myers's mask is they were looking for, you know, a mask to give this character, and they didn't have a lot of money, so they needed to kind of find some cheaper alternatives. So what they did is they grabbed a William Shatner mask and they cut the eye holes bigger and they spray painted it white and they threw on some fuzzy hair. And then
they cut the hair and they kind of changed it a bit.
Voila, you got your Michael Myers mask. And if you go look at it, you can Google it. There, you can find the juxtaposition of the two masks side by side. And you can see how they're very different. But you can see how kind of like the base model is Shatner's face, especially the nose, because the nose is exactly the same. And that's
it's not a great Shatner mask. But,
well, it's like old Shatner. It's like, you know, it's early Shatner.
Captain Kirk, right?
Yeah, Captain Kirk, right? And that's one of the things that people have applauded the most recent reboot of the franchise, was to bring back, like, even though it's got its own kind of newer iteration, it really pays homage to the original mask. It's like close facsimile of it. Whereas in 4 and 5, like, guy's got like slicked hair, he's got pursed lips, he's got smaller eyes. Like, I have no idea why they would want to screw with the mask design. Because there was some criticism. If you go back and look at 4 and 5, the mask of Myers looks way different. Like, he's got slicked hair, and that's not really what we're after here, right? So
it is interesting that they wouldn't sort of comprehend what they had already had, that they had something iconic, and then to start messing with it. You know, like, they didn't update Jason Voorhees goalie mask to be like a modern goalie mask.
Yeah, no, it's not like, imagine that.
Or like, on the side. He's got a painting of himself killing someone.
Give him a Jofa helmet.
Yeah, it wasn't like CCM sponsored him and, you know, had an update.
You know what the best would have been? Is it if he loses his mask and they give Jason a visor? Hey, he's like from Sweden.
Or he's got like a face paint, like he's just a huge Devils fan.
We're number one. We beat anybody. We're the Devils! The Devils!
He's got the jersey logo on his face.
You know, with all due respect to all our listeners from Sweden.
what did you just say? Oh, the Jova helmet?
No, the shield, eh?
Oh, the visor.
If they gave him a shield. Anybody that's listened to us now will know, like, we're Canadian. And if we get talking about hockey. But anyways, I digress.
Take off, eh?
The mask itself is totally iconic and amazing in many ways. Let me just ask you one thing. You know, well, you talked about it earlier about how he's going after like young women, right? He wanted to kill his sister.
Mm-hmm.
And we find out later that, you know, Laurie Strode is his biological sister. He was given up.
Oh, really? I don't even remember this part.
Oh yeah. No. So given up for adoption.
Or she was?
No, I think either she was.
And then people who live two doors down adopted her.
Yeah, we're finding some holes here, but Myers and her are their biological sister's brother. So why does he want to kill his family? It makes me think. So this is one of the things that we can talk about Myers. What's the likelihood that some kind of trauma existed in this boy's life before the original killing of his sister, Judith?
Yeah, you have to assume something set him off.
Something, right?
Which opens a plot door for a future writer. But, I mean, as is, it seems like he's mad because, or he's upset, or he's having some sort of weird reaction to the idea that his sister was with a man, and that somehow sets him off. And then he sort of reenacts that on these other women who are also sexually active. Like, it's I don't know. It's weird. Like, I get that he's repressed, but I mean, so is Laurie Strode. But I don't, Anyway, it's just a very like
typical I'm not going to speculate.
I don't want to get too deep in it because we've talked about this a million times that there's sort of a misogynistic undertone to a lot of the horror genre. But in this case,
I think this is one of the movies that started it.
Oh, yeah. And it's so prevalent. But because they give us so little to work on, I'm not going to try to speculate what makes him who he is. Is it problematic? I don't know. It speaks to what's wrong with him. He can't understand women and he can't understand that they have license over their own body. And he sort of has some sort of problem with that, or he's sort of reacting in some sort of angrily incel way.
There we go. Jesus, Rob.
I'm kidding. So that there is one thing with Michael. He is a funny guy. He does that whole sheet with glasses routine.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah.
He's like E.T. before E.T. did it. Like he has got some jokes.
Dude, we see that a couple of times, eh? He pulls that again in number four when he takes.
That scene cracks me up. What is he doing?
I guess maybe he's like the inner child, or the fact that he is so
No, I believe
it. You know, maybe the fact that he is so young. The house too. You know, he brings everything back to the house. So the Myers house is important, right? He's
a cat who kills mice and puts them on the front porch.
Listen, in a macro sense, I think this is what speaks to the intrigue of the whole franchise, is that I can understand revenge. I get going on about this, and when I actually take a look at the movie and when I rewatch the movie again, I always find myself just asking more questions and just being intrigued and engaged again in the whole franchise. And I think
it's a haunted house thing.
Well,
I kind of don't want it to be, because that'd be dumb, I think. But
yeah, I think there's probably more to that. I'm hoping it all comes full circle. Like Halloween ends. Well, in the title itself, there's finality to it, right? So I think we need, as fans, we need some answers as to really, and that is, like, it's the driving motivation of the entire story. I want to know why. And I think other people want to know why too.
So Jamie, how do you feel this movie stands up today? Should we bridge this right into our rating? Because I think that's where we should flesh it all out.
I think for all the things that we talked about tonight, a lot of it is timeless. I think the things that are tired is the, you know, having sex and getting killed, those classic horror tropes, those, you know, those things that any horror podcaster or anybody talking about horror discusses, anybody that watches or knows, those things are tired. Those things are, we need to move on and we need to move past them. So in a sense, that feels a bit aged, right? It also feels a little bit, aged with some of the cuts that you mentioned, right? Things that kind of take too long to develop. There's other ways to kind of create the tension by not just kind of having the same shot over and over, but the look of the movie is still, to this day, I think it holds up, and they use a lot of the same techniques in the newer movies, right? In part two, a lot of fire. We see that in some of the newer ones, but the look of the movies is awesome. Yeah. I guess the only thing that I was thinking about was, you know, where does this lie in, and where does this stand in the idea of, you know, the suburban, like, idea of the suburban American town being terrorized by a killer. It's like, how many movies were made like that before? And then also, we talked about this earlier, just before we started recording, is it like, if this was the first film really made about Halloween? And then it made me think, just, you know, if this was the first film that was, you know, dealing with, you know, a suburban American town. They say that in the piece, a suburban American town, you know, it makes me think, just like
in the trailer,
you know, in the trailer. So I think, you know, for its originality and for the iconic antagonist that it birthed in Myers, for me, this movie is, I'm going to give my rating right now, 5 footsteps out of 5 footsteps.
Oof. So you give that perfect score, eh?
There are fucking no toes in here, man.
The toes get chopped.
You know
off.
What? Like, it's just, you know, it's nostalgia for me. It's one of my favorite horror movies. It's, you know, I remember when I was a kid watching it, and now I'm an adult and I still enjoy it. I can still watch it. I bought the DVDs. I remember watching with my sister as a kid. It brings back a lot of memories, and I find it scary. It scared me. I love it.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, I had to really fight in my head about my nostalgia, because when you and I saw this in our teenage years, it was during that binge of franchises that we went on when I was working at Hollywood Video. And we went through the entire Halloween, although I remember at the time you'd already seen them and you knew to skip number three, being like, yeah, it's not really part of the storyline.
Season of the Witch.
Just skip it. I don't, to this day, I don't think I've seen number three. Anyway, so I was really competing with that, because I knew this sat in my brain as being a really great film in terms of like a horror cornerstone. And just like the fact that we rhymed off five things, and you know, we were different on one, so it's six things that make this movie very iconic and make it like so special, that really like should equal a footstep per thing there, right? And it should get a perfect score. I'm gonna take off a footstep though, and whoa, I'll tell you why.
Whoa,
I just watched this movie again two nights ago, whatever it was, and I had a hard time getting through it. I was a bit, frankly, I was bored. And the reason I was bored is that the storyline, I guess, was maybe just too, I knew where it was going. Maybe that's the problem, because I've seen it before. I know what's going to happen. And it's like 45, 50 minutes before Michael, like grown Michael, commits his first murder. And I felt like, especially with that first one, we are waiting for it for, I swear, 20 minutes. These babysitting scenes seem to go on forever. And frankly, as a father with two kids, I do not want to spend time watching other people raise kids. It's just boring. but what I mean is just like, yeah, I was like, come on, get to it. Like, and part of me wasn't like, I wasn't sure if the tension was always working. Like, especially the scene where the daughter of the cop sort of, first she spills, you know, something on her shirt. So she has to take off her shirt. Michael gets the peeping Tom on her. Then she goes out to the laundry facility, which is somehow like out in a gazebo in the backyard, and she locks herself in, and then she gets herself stuck in the window, and then the kid saves her. And I'm just like, holy cow, how long is this going to take? And Michael just keeps like kind of poking at her, but not like revealing himself. And it was silly. Like, she falls through the window and her butt's hanging out. And I was like, just like, okay. So this is where the movie started to ride on me a bit. And I was trying to get through it, partly because I was reviewing it too, maybe. And I was just like, okay, this is taking too long. There were parts of it, of course, that were great. Like, I love, we talked about the cinematography, all that. So, and then there's just like the cuts in the film. I identified the one earlier that was sort of a mistake, but also, again, this goes back to the 70s and how everything was slower then, but there's moments in the cut where it feels like there's a whole beat when you get to the cut from one scene to the other, or from one shot to another. And that beat is a beat that we would erase now in contemporary editing. We wouldn't allow that much space between the next point of action. And sometimes it's things like phone calls. Like, somebody says something, they cut. It's like you wait half a second and then the line is delivered. And so it feels totally unnatural to me. And there's moments where I'm like, oh boy, they could have just tightened this up. It feels like, you know, but again, 1978, we're reviewing this so many years later that I'm just having a hard time. But I do have to kick the step off, because I still have to treat it as a movie that I would watch today. I still have to review it from my time period now. And as a person in 2021 watching this, I did find it a bit plodding at times.
I think that one of the things to remember, because that sounds a bit patronizing, but when I rewatch this, I set myself up for success. So I turned off.
Go ahead, yes.
I turned off the lights and I got myself watching it, threw it on the TV. I allowed myself to be immersed into the whole story. And I found that I didn't have any problems with it. You know, sure, there, you know, especially it's a little annoying and a little bit redundant. In that one scene with, I think it's Annie's the character, where she's going back and forth and you're just waiting for something to happen. And when it does, the music comes in. Darr. And it does take a little bit long for those things. You know, as a teacher, I'm not gonna hold their feet to the fire on missing a beat with editing. For me, I don't hear the differences in that. I'm just kind of taking it for what it is, and it's the strengths completely outweighing what could be perceived as some weaknesses or some lengthening of sort of the middle sections of the plot. I'm not going to change mine, and it sounds like you're not going to either. But the only thing I would say to you is that you've rated, I believe, A Quiet Place and It Follows higher than Halloween.
Mm. But again, that speaks to like viewing from my contemporary, like from my position now. Like those movies are edited and feel paced, and you know they have this movie, you know, obviously to reflect on. Which Halloween has a different set of movies that it's reflecting on and a different time period. But I think at the time, if you were watching this 1978, you'd have to say, this is incredible. This is a 5-star movie. But in terms of standing the test of time, I do find there are some weak points that wear on me, and the representation of women, like that we talked about, the sort of like over the top friends with their cheap, ridiculous dialogue and the amount of times that the one girl says totally and
totally.
Yeah. And I actually say totally all the time. So
you're giving this a footstep off because it doesn't hold up today. Just like I gave a half a footstep off for It Follows because we couldn't make a sequel.
Hey man, there's no logic to this.
No, there isn't, is there?
No, but
you know, what we look for different things, and that's Rob. Yeah. Listen, this is what Running Scared is all about. Bringing different things to the table, man. Throwing different things into the pot, stirring it up and seeing what we make, all right? You look at it from a really like a critical film lens. And for me, I think I look at it as more of like, I don't want to say a fanboy, but nostalgia is huge for me. And I've always liked to take a really kind of bird's eye macro look at the film itself, right? Really try to immerse myself into the full vibe and feeling as to what's being created. And I love music and all that. Of course that, but it's interesting how we look at it a little bit differently, right? There's each of us has a little bit of noise in our judgment in terms of what we're trying to pull from it, what we think about it. So,
yeah, hey. I think in this one though, like I'm doing what you said, like I had to go back and watch that documentary to sort of really get a deeper appreciation of how much they accomplished when they made this film and how they really like made a mark in the genre and changed it for future films. And so that made me sort of reappreciate the movie. But what I'm knocking the footstep off for is that my sit down watching this in the dark with my headphones on, I got a bit bored and I was like, wow, this is taking a long time. And so I'm actually grading it from more of a fan standpoint of just like, was I entertained by this film? And I love to think about this film. I love to talk about this film. I love all the things that we've covered in this podcast today about what we liked about it. But in terms of just pure, just enjoyment, like, you know, this was like, I went to drink a Coke and they only had Pepsi, but I like Pepsi anyway. So it's pretty good, but it's not exactly what I, you know, I don't know. Maybe that's
it's like the, it's like she says, "We have Pepsi. Is that okay?" You're like, "Yeah, that's fine. Just give me that."
Right. That's the
How many times you go there? Slogan. Yeah. Can I get a Diet Coke? Is Pepsi okay? Yeah, I'll just take Pepsi.
Didn't Pepsi do a campaign where they said Pepsi is okay or something like that? Like, because they knew everyone said that.
Pepsi, it's okay.
Anyway,
they should have. All right, listen, man, that was good. Okay, so we're gonna wrap this up. I got 5 footsteps on Halloween 1978. You've got 4 out of 5 footsteps. Okay, so we didn't agree on this one, but I think we can both agree that it definitely has its place within the pantheon of horror films and was a groundbreaking film that spawned a lot of a lot of filmmakers and films that pay homage to it throughout the years.
All the other pods we've done, we probably had to reference Halloween at least once in each of them because it is that seminal piece that like everyone had to watch and should still watch.
Absolutely. Okay, so just before we get out of here, a couple of things. Even though that we or this person is not on our Patreon, I want to shout out our listener from Olds, Alberta. I don't know who you are, But right from the beginning of when we started recording Running Scared, it, to me, it looks like you've downloaded all our episodes and you're listening to them. Yeah, big fan out in Olds, Alberta, right? Just, I think, outside of Edmonton, out on the West Coast. So thank you for listening and being a part of the Running Scared community. Rob, what do we have coming up in the next week or so? Some exciting things, right? We talked about it at the top. Let's just recap it here.
Yeah, so we got Jogcast 2 currently in suite, almost done. That's coming along real soon. We've got Anaconda the Recast. That's going to take a little more time, but that'll be on the Patreon. I promise you it's got some very surprising and fun stuff in it. We really walked out onto a, into a weird space.
We walked out onto a limb and it broke.
And we hit every branch the way down.
All right, this is what we're going to do. We've got a list of three movies. First person that emails us in to the Running Scared Podcast at gmail.com, we're going to do that movie. We're going to shout you out on air. So here's the list: Hereditary, The Babadook, and The Witch.
Well, yeah, so we saw that in theaters together.
Yeah, these are three scary movies. So which one do you want? Okay, so again, first person, email us in, the Running Scared Podcast at gmail.com. We'll shout you out on air, and thank you for listening. Rob, this has been another great episode. I'm excited about all the things that are going to be happening in the next week to week and a half. It's going to be fantastic. I hope everything is good with you in the new house, and I am signing off because I'm going to be going and enjoying my birthday tomorrow. So
yeah, big shout out to Jamie here, birthday number 42, and you know, we all wish you a happy birthday, bud.
Thanks, man. All right, later.
The Running Scared Podcast is written and produced by Robert Lendrum and Jamie Roberts, with original music by Jamie Roberts. Edited by Robert Lendrum.
Reach out to us on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and we'll see you next time on Running Scared.
I spent 8 years trying to reach him, and then another 7 trying to keep him locked up, because I realized that what was living behind that boy's eyes was purely and simply evil.